Democracy Now!. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
It's 5 p.m. This is KBOO Portland. KBOO programming is made possible by KBOO member listeners and support from Portland Saturday Market. 46 years of American-made arts and crafts, freshly prepared international foods, local artisans and local music in downtown Portland. Open every Saturday and Sunday in Waterfront Park, now through Christmas Eve. Event schedule, vendor information, and more at PortlandSaturdayMarket.com.
Hello, KBOO members. Thank you for being a part of our amazing community. Please join us this year at Mic to the People, our annual election meeting. Do you want to help steer KBOO in a positive direction this fall? Plan on attending the annual election meeting, Mic to the People, September 14th from noon to 3 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater and make your voice heard. Cast your vote by 1 p.m. at the event and enjoy refreshments and live entertainment with local musicians West Coast Black Bear and Izzy BM. Hear a report back from your board of directors and get to know this year's candidates. Record your fondest memories of KBOO in a minute or less at the Mic to the People booth. This is an all-ages and disability-affirmative event. Again, that's the annual election meeting, Mic to the People, Saturday, September 14th from noon to 3 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street, featuring West Coast Black Bear and Izzy BM. More information can be found at kboo.fm/meeting2019. Remember, your voice matters.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, a four-alarm fire in Northeast Portland claims one home and two commercial buildings.
Oregon's university and grocery workers prepare for a potential strike.
And a judge in Missouri has blocked a bill banning abortions.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, August 27th, 2019. I'm Yasmin Kobanoglu.
And I'm Leslie McLam. A four-alarm fire last night caused a section of 82nd Avenue to be closed and nearby residents to be evacuated. The fire started in the field of a long-closed driving range across from Madison High School. Years of negligent maintenance resulted in tall, dry grass, which burned rapidly, spreading to nearby buildings. And one building, the abandoned Cascade Athletic Club, was completely destroyed. Behind that building was an overflow lot belonging to Cascade Motors car dealership. 50 to 60 cars were parked there, and all of them were destroyed, causing around $500,000 in damage. Melted aluminum flowed like lava from a volcano. The neighboring skate park, the lumberyard, received minor smoke and water damage, and three houses sustained major damage. Local residents had to be evacuated, and many were not able to return to their homes until this morning. Nearby businesses were shut down, and power was cut off in the area for about 6 hours. KBOO reporter Al Khan was at the scene earlier today and spoke with fire crews and local residents. Fire officials would not comment on the cause of the blaze, which is pending on investigation. However, several local residents said there were houseless people that had been taking shelter in the old driving range building. Our reporter investigated the driving range, entering through an existing hole in the surrounding fence, and found the remnants of the camp and a makeshift fire pit that may have been the source of the blaze.
The Multnomah Fire Defense Board Chief, Scott Lewis, has issued an outdoor burn ban effective immediately across all of Multnomah County. The burn ban was issued because of forecasted high temperatures, limited rainfall, and ongoing dry conditions in the region. The order comes just one day after the four-alarm grass fire in Northeast Portland. The ban includes recreational campfires, fire pits, yard debris, agricultural burning, and permits issued for open burning until further notice. Outdoor barbecuing is still allowed, however, residents should exercise caution. When using charcoal briquettes, properly dispose of ashes in a covered metal container away from combustibles, and keep the ashes wet for a few days before properly disposing of them. The Multnomah Fire Defense Board also recommends maintaining at least 10 feet between outdoor cooking and anything combustible, such as siding, fences, and shrubbery. In addition, those living in rural areas should maintain their defensible space by monitoring growth surrounding structures and maintaining adequate access for firefighting equipment.
On Friday, Oregon Democratic senators announced that they would not seek to impose fines on Republicans who walked out of the Capitol to avoid a June vote in a Democratic climate bill. At that time, the Republican minority realized that they did not have the votes to defeat the bill, but knew that if they deprived the Senate of the ability to establish a quorum, the bill would not be able to come up for a vote. So 11 Republican senators walked out. In response, Governor Kate Brown ordered the Oregon State Police to bring the missing senators back to work and imposed a $500 per day fine on those who refused to return. Right-wing groups promised to protect the absent Republicans, and Senator Brian Boquist went so far as to publicly warn the police to, quote, send bachelors and come heavily armed. But the missing senators had gone into hiding, and the state police were unable to locate them. In the statement announcing the abandonment of the fines, the state's Democrats noted that imposing the fines would require, quote, lengthy litigation involving hundreds of thousands of dollars. As an alternative, the Senate Democrats will introduce a constitutional amendment in the 2020 legislative session to lower quorum requirements. Oregon voters will have the opportunity to vote on the amendment as part of the 2020 general election.
Grocery workers in Oregon and Southwest Washington have voted to approve a strike if deals cannot be reached. Members of United Food and Commercial Workers Local 555 have been fighting with employers over wages for more than a year. The union represents over 20,000 regional grocery workers and has been pushing Albertson Safeway, Fred Meyer, and QFC to increase workers' wages. The union has said that in order to avoid a strike, its members will need to see an offer of a notable wage increase on the table. Both sides will meet for continued negotiations on Thursday. Similarly, more than 5,000 classified employees at Oregon's seven public universities are also considering striking. Members of SEIU Local 503 were disappointed by the final contract offer received from university management last week. The union is made up of classified employees, which are university employees who are not faculty or administration. This includes clerical and office staff, IT workers, childcare specialists, kitchen workers, and custodians. The union represents workers from Eastern Oregon University, the Oregon Institute of Technology, Oregon State University, Southern Oregon University, the University of Oregon, and Western Oregon University. The two sides recently entered into a month-long cooling period during which a strike is not allowed. However, university workers are preparing to strike once that period ends, unless university management presents a better offer in the interim.
A new homeless shelter opened yesterday in Northwest Portland, financed by a combination of public and private funds. The Harbor of Hope River District Navigation Center will provide shelter and support for up to 100 people at a time. The idea of a navigation center was pioneered in San Francisco and other cities and provides temporary housing and services to help shelter residents move into permanent housing as quickly as possible. It also has laundry facilities, showers, and other services. Harbor of Hope was driven by Portland developer Homer Williams. He raised about $3 million from Columbia Sportswear CEO Tim Boyle and other private donations to cover construction costs. The city waived permit fees associated with the project, and the Navigation Center is built on land that was donated by Portland's Urban Renewal Agency. The city retains ownership of the land, and the Joint Office of Homeless Services has agreed to finance its first year's operating budget. The funding will cover costs associated with staff, programming, and day-to-day needs at the shelter. This is the third shelter to open in Portland this year.
The Multnomah County Board of Commissioners has outlined the likely impacts of a $7.7 million budget cut to local law enforcement, jails, and probation. The cuts will be voted on this Thursday. As planned, the cuts would lead to shutting down 73 of the county's already low number of jail beds and the elimination of about two dozen different positions. It is unclear exactly how many people would be laid off. The changes are the result of cuts adopted by the state, combined with over-optimistic budgeting by the county. According to officials, the largest hit will be for the Department of Community Justice, with as many as 19 positions being cut among probation and parole officers, counselors, and managers. The Multnomah County Sheriff's Office will cut 7.2 corrections deputy positions, leading to the closure of what amounts to an entire jail dorm. The 73 beds cut represents a 6% reduction to the current total of 1,192 beds. As the result of the new cuts, the county will also reduce the number of short-term transitional beds it had been funding for adult inmates released from custody, as well as cut supervision and eligibility for the Justice Reinvestment Program, which works to keep people out of state prison.
This weekend, City Commissioner Joanne Hardesty spoke at the Willamette Hip Hop River Festival about the river cleanup, accessibility, and hip hop in Portland. Her comments follow a brief introduction by Donovan Smith of the Portland Harbor Community Coalition.
Or hopefully we can prevent some of the privatization of our Willamette River. But from the Broadway Bridge, which is over by the Rose Garden, Nova Center for Newer People, all the way down to Solvies Island, that is where this billion-dollar cleanup is going to happen of the Willamette River. That cleanup is only for 13% of the worst toxins in our river, but it's what we got. It's federally mandated. Now, how many of us knew that it was one of the most toxic sites in the country? Okay. Any of us familiar with the term Superfund? There's about 150 what they call potentially responsible parties. So since 2000, this site on the Willamette has been designated as a Superfund. And there used to be a lot of money in it to clean up the toxic sites. Because as people have been exploiting the planet, they've been polluting it for the last few hundred years of colonization, essentially. And so our river is one of the victims of it. I'd be lying to you if I said it's gonna be clean. But I'm gonna pass the mic to our commissioner, Joanne Hardesty, who is gonna tell you a little bit more about the city of Portland and how they fit into this whole cleanup and why this thing is important. So make some noise for Joanne Hardesty, Commissioner Joanne Hardesty.
Thank you for being out here. I would be remiss if I didn't say that hip hop has been under attack in Portland ever since I've lived here. There are very few venues in the city of Portland today where hip hop can take place without having way too many police officers coming to check and see what's going on, without scaring club managers about, oh, you can't have hip hop because that's gonna bring gang members. We have to stand up and make sure that every kind of music is appreciated in the city of Portland. There are some festivals that they give up a big bucks for, and for hip hop, they've done everything in their power to kill it. So I just want you to know that I am not unaware of the challenge of utilizing your talent as hip hop artists in the city of Portland. But also know you've got a friend at City Hall, because I am absolutely committed to calling out injustice wherever I find it. And it doesn't matter how much people squirm and get uncomfortable, because after all, we are in the Pacific Northwest and people don't like to have straight talk happen, right? So let's talk about the Willamette River and the responsible parties who've actually polluted our waterways. Government entities have polluted our waterways, whether that's Port of Portland, whether that's the city of Portland or Metro, all down the list, every single government entity that operates in the city of Portland are part of the responsible parties. But many of the businesses that got tax breaks and got tax relief to operate in the city of Portland are no longer in business. They are gone. We don't know where they are. They've disappeared. They're no longer conducting business today. And there is a feeling, at least for me and some others, that we, the taxpayers, are gonna be caught paying the bill. We have an obligation to make sure that every company that's in business today pays their fair share for this cleanup, and we cannot once again leave the burden to the people who are left behind once that cleanup happens. Now, if you look at this absolutely beautiful river, what you know is that most riverways you have houses that are so expensive that regular people can't afford to live in, right? So what you know is that when we clean this river up, there are going to be all kind of economic development opportunities for folks who want to come and just relax on this beautiful, beautiful river, right? But we have to make sure that we, the people who have lived here, who have helped struggle through getting a commitment to clean it up, that we also benefit from that cleanup. We have billions upon billions of dollars being spent over the next few years in the city of Portland and Metro and other government entities. And I gotta tell you, every time I ask the question, so like, who's getting all those million-dollar contracts, right? I get this, first they get a little uncomfortable. And then I get this, well, you know, we had 21% MWESB participation. And you know, I know what that means, but you know, some days it's good to play dumb, right? I go, I don't know what that means. I wanna know how many black people, how many Latinos, how many Native Americans, how many women. I need the breakdown. And then I wanna know what companies they are. Because if they are not investing in our community, they should not be at the front of the line for those government resources, right? And are they local? And are they vested in the communities that they're working in? Let's have fun today. Let's enjoy this absolutely beautiful, one of our last beautiful days of summer. Let's enjoy this day, but next week, let's get back to work, making sure that the beauty of Oregon and Portland, we all get to enjoy. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner.
That was Portland City Commissioner Joanne Hardesty speaking at the Illamit Hip Hop River Festival.
Oregon Health and Science University has been approved to resume its heart transplant program. The United Network for Oregon Sharing approved OHSU's new primary physician for heart transplants, allowing the hospital to resume its program. The hospital said in a news release that the decision made by the network was unanimous and effective as of Monday. OHSU had previously suspended Oregon's only heart transplant program last summer after four cardiologists left the hospital. After the suspension, the hospital called for internal and external reviews of the program. The review found that, along with communication issues, there were too few cardiologists, so they burned out quickly. OHSU says it has already hired three heart specialists so far and plans to hire another two to prevent staffing shortage issues. The announcement comes just days before the deadline that would have required the hospital to go through a lengthy recertification process. Now the program must actually perform a heart transplant to retain its status with the U.S. Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast at 5:30 for Totality of Circumstances with KBOO's Sam Bowman and Jasmine Moneymaker. At 6 p.m., it's Preference. And then at 7, Calculated Conversation. Tonight's weather will be clear skies with a low of 62 degrees. Tomorrow will be mostly sunny with a high of 96 degrees. Today in history. In 1955, the first edition of the Guinness Book of Records is published in Great Britain. The quote of the day is from American physician and astronaut Mae Jemison, who said, quote, "The biggest challenge we all face is to learn about ourselves and to understand our strengths and weaknesses. We need to utilize our strengths, but not so much that we don't work on our weaknesses."
The reusable water bottle brand Contigo has issued a recall for their kids' cleanable water bottles. According to the U.S. Consumer Product Safety Commission, the water bottles have been recalled because a silicone spout on the bottle can detach and pose a choking hazard for children. Only the black color spout base and spout cover models are included in the recall. Contigo has received 149 complaints, including 18 incidents in which the spout was discovered in a child's mouth. No injuries have occurred. However, recalled bottles should be immediately taken from children. The bottles were sold at Costco, Walmart, Target, and other brick-and-mortar stores nationwide as well as online. About 5.7 million total bottles were sold individually, as well as in packs of 2 and 3. The bottles come in three sizes, 13, 14, and 20 ounces, and four colors: solid, graphics, stainless steel, and stainless steel solid. The word Contigo is printed on the rim and near the bottom front of the bottle. Contigo will supply a free replacement lid for faulty products. If you think you might have one of the recalled water bottles, visit recall.gocontigo.com.
The Trump administration is planning to move at least $155 million from the Federal Emergency Management Agency's Disaster Relief Fund in order to support its policy of deporting migrants. The Department of Homeland Security informed Congress that it would reprogram and transfer $271 million in total to the Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agency. Funding will be transferred from the Coast Guard, TSA, and FEMA, just as Tropical Storm Dorian nears hurricane strength as it approaches Puerto Rico. The money will then be used to fund an average of 45,000 detention beds per day. In recent months, the agency has been consistently holding more people in detention than beds available. According to the agency, as of August 10th, 55,530 people are being held in the U.S. in immigration detention.
A federal judge in Missouri has blocked a law banning abortions after 8 weeks. U.S. District Judge Howard Sachs wrote in an 11-page opinion, quote, "The legislation on its face conflicts with the Supreme Court ruling that neither legislative or judicial limits on abortion can be measured by specified weeks or development of a fetus. Instead, viability is the sole test for a state's authority to prohibit abortions where there is no maternal health issue." This ruling comes after two other federal judges blocked similar abortion restriction bills in Arkansas and Ohio. The Missouri law would prohibit medical professionals from performing abortions after 8 weeks into pregnancy. This is often before many women know that they are pregnant and well before the 24-week viability standard established in Roe v. Wade. Doctors who perform abortions would also be punished with up to 15 years in prison. The Missouri law does not include exceptions for rape or incest, only for medical emergency. Acting president and CEO of Planned Parenthood, Alexis McGill Johnson, praised the judge's ruling, saying, quote, "Today's decision blocks a harmful law that bans abortion before many know they're pregnant. What little abortion access in Missouri is left will stay in place for the time being."
And now it's time for today's report from National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Indigenous news, issues, and culture. On today's episode, federal charges will not be pursued in the missing and murdered Indigenous woman's case in Montana, and the nomination of the Cherokee Nation delegate to Congress will go before the Nation Council.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The U.S. Attorney's Office for Montana has announced it will not pursue federal charges in the death of a young girl whose body was found near Lame Deer on the Northern Cheyenne Reservation last year. The office determined it could not prove foul play. Kayla DeRoche with Yellowstone Public Radio has more.
14-year-old Henny Scott's body was found in late December 2018, a few weeks after she was last seen alive. According to the U.S. Attorney Office's press release, she passed due to hypothermia with no evidence of major trauma, and alcohol was a condition in her death. The same release says a follow-up investigation determined that when Scott was last seen, she was wearing light clothing in below-freezing temperatures. In the past, her mother, Paula Castro, has expressed doubt about forensic findings. 5 months following the discovery of her daughter's body, Castro spoke to a crowd in Billings who gathered to march and raise awareness about missing and murdered Indigenous people.
They say she died from hypothermia, but it was warm.
Dean Walling Bull, an activist in Lame Deer who organized several marches following the discovery of Henny Scott's body, says he heard about the U.S. Attorney Office's announcement.
I don't want to be angry or mad about that decision and whoever made it, whoever decided that, you know. I'm going to pray about it.
Walling Bull says Scott's death brought heightened attention to the issue of missing and murdered women and girls, and it's not over.
Other people are going to experience this, and it's going to be hard for them, you know, and we don't want that to happen. We pray that that doesn't happen, but that's in our reality, it's not like that, you know? It's different here.
Montana established the Missing Indigenous Persons Task Force this year. Its duties will include improving communication between tribal, state, and federal agencies and managing a database of missing people. For National Native News, I'm Kayla DeRoche, reporting from Billings, Montana.
The new leader of the Cherokee Nation says initiatives to strengthen sovereignty include enacting the Oklahoma Tribe's treaty right to send a delegate to Congress. Cherokee Nation Principal Chief Chuck Hoskin Jr. nominated Kim Teehee, the tribe's vice president of government relations, to serve as the delegate. Teehee has experience advocating in Congress and served in the Obama administration as a Native American policy advisor. Her nomination is set to go before the tribal council on Thursday. According to the Cherokee Nation, the delegate is referenced in treaties in the 1700s and 1800s. Naming a delegate is part of Hoskin's first 100 days in office, which he took August 14th. Teehee says the Cherokee Nation will work with Oklahoma's congressional delegation to move her appointment forward. The Navajo Nation signed an agreement Monday with Central Consolidated Schools to have Navajo police officers assigned to schools in Shiprock and Newcomb, New Mexico. The Farmington Daily Times reports the agreement will place an officer at the high schools starting August to May 2020. The agreement follows tribal, state, and federal laws. The initiative is part of safety efforts to address the vast size of the district and the need for police to respond quickly to situations. Safety concerns were raised after the 2017 school shooting, which claimed the lives of two students off the reservation in the nearby town of Aztec. The tribe hopes the agreement can be a model for other districts which operate on tribal land. U.S. attorneys from across the country are meeting in New Mexico this week. The Attorney General's Advisory Subcommittee on Native American Issues will gather Wednesday in Santa Ana, Pueblo. The group is examining federal programs and policies to reduce violent crime and substance abuse in Native communities. Attorneys are expected to visit the Pueblo of Acoma on Thursday. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Bangladesh's top court has decided that the word virgin must be removed from Muslim marriage certificates. The landmark verdict comes after critics challenged the term as being, quote, humiliating and discriminatory. Bangladesh is the world's third largest Muslim majority nation, with nearly 90% of its population identifying as Muslim. Under Bangladesh's Muslim marriage law, a bride has to select one of three options on the certificate: whether she is a virgin, a widow, or divorced. The nation's high court has now ordered the government to remove the word virgin and replace it with unmarried. The court is expected to publish its full verdict by October, when the changes to the certificate will most likely go into effect. Human rights groups have long criticized the term, which has been used in the country since 1961, saying it violates the privacy of the woman getting married. Ainun Nahar Siddiqa, a lawyer for Bangladesh Legal Aid and Services Trust, said, quote, "It's a ruling that gives us the belief that we can fight and create more changes for women in the future." The judgment also ordered authorities to introduce the options of unmarried, widower, or divorced for the groom on the certificate as well.
And now, from the Yale Center for Environmental Communication, it's Climate Connections. On today's episode, one family business's journey to sustainable energy.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. At Cox Printers in New Jersey, marketing brochures, booklets, and pamphlets roll off the presses. The business has been in Michael Kaufman's family for more than 35 years, so when his kids were growing up, they often spent time there.
When they wanted to stay home sick with the snivels, we're like, okay, you can come and shrink wrap.
One day, when Kaufman's daughter was just 7, she came to him with a suggestion: installing solar panels on the roof of the family business. At the time, Kaufman did not own the building, so he had to say no. But the idea stuck with him, and 10 years ago, when the company bought its own space, he took action.
One of the first things we did was we added solar to the roof. That directly ties into the electric needed to power the presses.
They later added 2 wind turbines to help power the graphics department and installed efficient lighting and air conditioning. Now, there's even a rooftop garden with vegetables, flowers, and 3 beehives. The changes are good for the climate, and Kaufman says his customers appreciate them too.
people who care about the environment. They want to use a printer who's powering his presses with his own solar power on the roof and reusing and recycling everything they can.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. Learn more at yaleclimateconnections.org.
Current Cast is a daily podcast that highlights issues affecting one of our most precious resources, fresh water. On today's episode, algae and what to do about it.
The good guys of the algae world on this Current Cast. In a stagnant pond, you may see what looks like matted green hair floating in the water. But it's not a swamp monster. It's filamentous green algae.
People typically go, but the truth is that they're totally benign. They don't produce toxins. They're incredibly beneficial because they're reducing nutrients in the water.
Michael Piotrowski of the University of Wisconsin-Madison says if the algae die, then nutrients go back in the water. That can fuel the growth of toxic algae blooms. So he says to get rid of unsightly filamentous algae,
physically rake it out, scoop it up, whatever.
In the process, you'll help keep excess nutrients out of the water, too. Current Cast is produced in partnership with Cornell University's Atkinson Center for a Sustainable Future. Learn more online at currentcast.org.
The president of Brazil, Jair Bolsonaro, has demanded that French President Emmanuel Macron withdraw his comments on the Amazon fires. Bolsonaro is a right-wing nationalist who has been accused of greenlighting a new era of environmental destruction in Brazil. Bolsonaro has attacked the French president's, quote, lamentable colonialist stance as he rejected $20 million in G7 contributions to fight the fires. Bolsonaro rejected Macron's criticism of his environmental record and instead flaunted Donald Trump's support for his far-right administration. Speaking about Macron, Bolsonaro said, quote, "We have nothing against the G7. We have something against one of the G7's presidents." Bolsonaro has said that if Macron withdraws his statements, he would reconsider accepting the aid package.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, August 27th, 2019. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories and tips at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Al Kahn, Yasmin Kobanoglu, and Ray Bodwell. The producer is Yasmin Kobanoglu, and our engineer is Jeff Henderson. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Yasmin Kobanoglu.
And I'm Leslie McLam. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO, beginning at 7 a.m., it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. Next at 8, it's Wednesday Talks Radio. At 9, it's The Radio Activist with guest host Rachel Dixon. Then at 10, Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. And at 11, it's Radio Zine. All of these KBOO programs are made possible by member support. If you'd like to become a member, just go to kboo.fm and click on Donate.
Thank you for listening to the KBOO Evening News and to this show, Totality of Circumstances. I'm Sam Bowman. This is a show that focuses on policing from a holistic perspective, with a special focus on community responses to and organizing around the issues of policing and police accountability. The name of this show, Totality of Circumstances, is a legal term that often pops up in investigations of police uses of force, when a cop's actions will be judged based on the so-called totality of circumstances that were known to the cop at the exact moment they used force. Never mind the harm done to the person they use force on, the harm done to their families and loved ones, or the individual history of the police officer, the civilian, and the communities and systems they came from, the real totality of circumstances. This week we have a bit of a Frankenstein show, stitched together from original content, old audio from this show, and some recent stories produced by the volunteer KBOO reporters for the evening news. That's because even though you are hearing my voice on the air in Portland, my physical form is in Chicago at this very moment. This is the magic of radio, and the particular magic of KBOO that they allow us to get away with this sort of lowbrow stuff. Anyway, the big story, in case you've been trapped in a soundproof booth with no internet access for the past month, is the demonstration and counter-demonstrations that occurred on both sides of the waterfront and other parts of downtown Portland last Saturday. At first, the cops kept both sides rigidly separated, playing the part of salami in the middle of a pumpernickel and Wonder Bread sandwich. Soon after the scheduled protest began, however, they allowed the Proud Boy-led demonstrators to cross the Hawthorne Bridge and focused their energy on the remaining anti-fascist counter-demonstrators. Later on in the show, we'll hear a report from the scene and an interview conducted the week before the protests with an anti-fascist organizer. But first, I want to talk about something that happened months ago, way back in May. If you've ever listened to this show, you know we love to cover the Citizen Review Committee, the 11-member, all-volunteer body that reviews police misconduct cases. Despite other developments over the past year, the CRC is still probably the most powerful tool citizens have to hold police accountable in any way. The most powerful, that is, if you don't count being elected mayor. Before he was elected in 2016, Ted Wheeler made police accountability a major part of his platform. He was not only willing to back up the mandate of the city's accountability system, led by the Auditor's Independent Police Review Division, or IPR, but at least in January of 2017, he was willing to wade into a crowd of angry protesters outside City Hall to do it.
There is a process that has been established in this city to take complaints and review them. And I take it seriously. If anybody has not acted in accordance with the Bureau rules, they'll be punished for it.
Then, in May of this year, as we reported at the time, a police misconduct case was appealed all the way to City Council, and the council voted 3-1 to sustain a finding against Officer Neil Parker for retaliating against a woman who was filming police vehicles outside of North Precinct back in May of 2017. It was a historic vote, the third time in its 18-year history that a case appealed to the CRC made it all the way to City Council, and the first time that council took action that would, at least in theory, result in the discipline of an officer. The one vote against disciplining Officer Parker came from Mayor Ted Wheeler, who read a statement laying out his reasoning for voting no.
The officer in this case saw a law violation, improper position on the roadway. As I said, he had the legal discretion to make a stop to identify the violator, investigate the violation, and then issue the warning. And as I say, the officer issued the citation. The judge convicted the violator. In his interview, the officer said he did not care if he was filmed. And he further said that he did not write the citation because of legally filming him. The officer denied, on the record, retaliation. And there's no factual evidence that exists in the record that proves this allegation. There's a number of concerns the officer did raise in his interviews. He said he was aware that at the time there were numerous ambush-style attacks on police officers. He said he was also aware that there had been recent vandalism of police cars at the North Precinct. He said there was also a BOLO, a be on the lookout for a man and a woman associated with a U-Haul van that was a safety concern, and he was aware of that. He said he was aware that there were several film the police people regularly harassing police both at work and at their homes, and in his interview, he said he did not object if he was filmed, and he did not write the citation because of legal filming. The CRC's assessment that the reviewing lieutenant was unreasonable in concluding not sustain is, in my opinion, not supported by the legal standard, and that's where my difference of opinion is. The officer acted legally, he acted in policy, and he did not engage in misconduct. The actions of the officer are reasonable, and the conclusions arrived at in the review process by the officer's lieutenant, the commander, the chief of the operations branch, the captain of internal affairs, the independent police review assistant director, as well as the chief of police, all concluded not sustained. If the chief or I believe that there was a violation supported by the evidence, we would take appropriate action.
That was Mayor Ted Wheeler on May 16th reading his reasons for voting no on disciplining Officer Neil Parker for retaliating against a civilian who was filming police vehicles at North Precinct. KABU recently obtained emails through a public records request which show that what the mayor was reading from were talking points drafted by his public safety advisor, Robert King. King was hired for the position in April on a $99,000 a year salary in the wake of the scandal over friendly text messages between far-right organizer Joey Gibson, who was there on last Saturday at the Portland waterfront, and Police Lieutenant Jeffrey Nia, who was once in charge of organizing the police response to such demonstrations. Many Portland officers, and especially their powerful union, the Portland Police Association, or PPA, objected to what they saw as Wheeler and other Portland officials throwing Nia under the bus for conducting business as usual. King's hiring was widely seen as a gesture of goodwill from Wheeler to police officers. King retired in late 2017 after a 27-year career with the Portland Police, ending his tenure while serving as commander of North Precinct, a tenure which included the day in May of 2017 when a woman was given a jaywalking citation by Officer Neil Parker after filming police vehicles with an ugly look on her face. King also served as president of the Portland Police Association for several years in the 2000s. I reached out to the mayor's office and Mr. King on August 1st to ask if King had written the talking points alone, with the mayor, or with anyone else, and if the mayor and King had collaborated on the language in any way. With no response, I reached out again on the 15th, and again on the 20th, at which point I got a response from Wheeler's communications director Eileen Park thanking me for my inquiry and saying, quote, "At this time, we have no further comment," unquote. Of course, just because they may have been written by the former president of the PPA doesn't mean that Wheeler didn't feel the sentiment of the talking points himself. After reading from them, the mayor took a solo and told us how he really feels about the city's accountability system and the ability of citizens to appeal its decisions.
Before I cast my obvious vote based on what I've just said, there's something else I want to say. This is a process that is prescribed by city charter, and I have serious concerns about this process. I have concerns about having a simple majority of an elected city council being able to overturn the police commissioner, the chief, the independent police review, the internal affairs, the chief of operations, the commander, and the lieutenant on what is effectively an HR disciplinary matter. Now, this council has done its duty. This is what we are required to do under the current charter, but this is one more area where I wonder whether this is really a fair or a reasonable process. I vote no. The motion carries.
I also asked Wheeler's office if he would be willing to do a short interview on this show to explain his reasoning against the appeal process, given that police accountability remains a major concern to many of the people in Portland who elected him. Through communications director Park, he declined. And that is why a significant portion of the rest of the show will be a musical break. We'll be right back. you, that is Eye of the Storm by Underground Resistance, Detroit's finest. And now, let's get into the events of Saturday, August 17th. We'll start with an interview that aired on the KBOO News on Thursday, August 15th, when predictions of what might happen at the event ranged from bad to mass destruction. Here, KBOO volunteer Mackenzie Beard speaks with a Rose City Antifa activist named Isaac about their plans and expectations for the event.
Why don't we get started by you just telling us a little about Rose City Antifa?
So Rose City Antifa is the longest-running anti-fascist organization in the U.S. that uses the name Antifa. We were founded in 2007, and for the last 12 years, we've exposed and opposed neo-Nazis, white supremacists, and fascists in Portland.
So how'd you get involved in the organization?
I got involved a few years ago because I saw that there were a lot more fascists popping up locally, and I wanted to do something to oppose.
So then, can you tell us a little about what are some of the core beliefs or actions of a fascist organization, then, that you're opposing?
We have a large definition of this on our website, but we see fascism as a very, like, complex ideology that includes such items as extreme nationalism, misogyny, the desire and willingness to use violence against marginalized populations, the creation of or desire to do harm to a marginalized population. So those are some of the things that we see fascists doing, or that we some of the parts of fascist ideology. As for what they do, we see that they organize a lot of demonstrations, they try to gain street power, and they try to intimidate marginalized populations.
So then what's going on Saturday in Portland?
So on Saturday, a group known as the Proud Boys, a white nationalist organization, is holding a rally downtown on the waterfront. The purpose of this rally is expressly to try to do violence against anti-fascist community self-defense organizations. If you look at the sort of rhetoric they've been using on their social media, it's a lot about, it has images of anti-fascist activists being killed. There's a lot of violent threats. So we, along with other anti-fascist organizations like Pop Mob, are calling for a community response to oppose and denounce this violent rhetoric and show that these organizations, like the Proud Boys, that they're not welcome in our city.
So then how are the Proud Boys different from other fascist organizations we see, like, for instance, Patriot Prayer?
So the Proud Boys are a larger, more national organization than Patriot Prayer. Patriot Prayer and the Proud Boys used to have a lot more overlap than they do now, but essentially we see that the Proud Boys are much more willing to forego the sort of free speech argument that Patriot Prayer would use and are much more bald-faced about their willingness and desire to use violence against their political opponent.
What trends have you seen between the religious right and the connection of that and fascism today?
This is one I'm not as versed on. Most of the so-called alt-right organizations don't have as much of connection with the extreme wings of, like, the evangelical movement, for example. So in terms of organizations we're countering right now, a lot of them will use religious rhetoric, but they're not explicitly tied to those movements in terms of overlap of organizers and things like that.
So as far as the rally and demonstration in Portland this weekend, how do you expect it to be similar or different, you know, since the rally in July when Antifa members were falsely accused of throwing, you know, quick cement in milkshakes and the attack on Andy Ngo?
I think in terms of police response, we've seen that the police are telegraphing via their communications that they would really like to crack down on both anti-fascists out there in community self-defense and on the far right. Whether that will play out as it did on August 4th, 2018, when the police sort of, when the police attacked a large group of anti-fascists unprovoked, we'll have to see.
How do you feel that the city of Portland and government officials have responded to the recent clashes between protesters and counter-protesters?
It depends on the part of the city. There have been some people within the city government who seem to have wised up to the fact that community self-defense organizations and the violent bigots who are coming in to attack our city are not the same. But we've seen a lot of other people in the city, including Ted Wheeler, waffle on this and make equivalencies between everyday anti-fascists out there in community self-defense and the Proud Boys and other white nationalists.
So let's talk a little bit more about Ted Wheeler. Yesterday, him and a coalition of over 100 groups met to talk and to denounce violence at this weekend's protest. Can you talk a little bit about your response to that?
So we think that energy would have been better spent bringing those groups out on Saturday when those violent bigots and white nationalists, white supremacists will actually be there I think it's all well and good to make a rhetorical stand, but it's even more important to be there physically on the day of to show in numbers that we don't want these people in our city.
So can we talk a little bit about the rise of fascism in Portland today? Compared to other U.S. cities, it seems like Portland regularly has these clashes and issues. Why is that?
Yeah, I think that'd be fair to say. I think that's because, one, we've had an extremely dedicated far-right organizer in the form of Joey Gibson, who's been willing to sort of organize these demonstrations again and again. But I think it's also because Portland has become sort of emblematic on the far-right for a city that has, you know, stood up to ICE, stood up time and time again. They see it as a city that they want to beat, essentially, to show that they've won against, you know, the left and liberals, people who are out there defending our community from white supremacy.
And what exactly has Joey Gibson done recently in Portland? What have his activities looked like?
For the past 2 months, he has not been up to much after his being sued by the owner of Cider Riot for his part there in leading an attack on that bar. But prior to that, he had obviously been one of the main organizers of a number of extremely violent and aggressive demonstrations that were filled to the brim with white supremacists, fascists, and white nationalists.
In your opinion, what is the best way to fight fascism today?
I think we always need to take a varied approach. The fight against fascism is not going to be won by a single tactic, but by a multitude of tactics, whether that's informing the community, whether that's, you know, pressure campaigns against white nationalist organizers, or whether it's education about the roots of white supremacy in our community and how to fight those.
So then how can our listeners get involved to help fight fascism in Portland?
One of the best ways would be to come out this Saturday, August 17th, at the waterfront. Another great way, though, is we and other anti-fascists will often put up campaigns on our social media, and following those and getting involved in those campaigns by doing call-ins and things like that are excellent ways to take action against white supremacist organizers in your community.
And if you had any final words for our listeners, a last message, what would that be?
Don't be afraid. Come out on Saturday. We're going to beat them.
For KBOO News, I'm Mackenzie Beard.
Saturday's events didn't go exactly as anybody planned. At least I don't think so, from my vantage point. But why listen to me? I wasn't there. In this clip, KBOO News director Althea Billing speaks with eyewitness Sean Stevens. This aired on Monday, the 19th.
So, Sean, why don't you recount to me what your experience was at the protest on Saturday?
So I had shown up pretty early. I didn't know that it was supposed to start at 11 o'clock, so I got there about 9 o'clock. I had parked on the east side, and so I kind of was walking around and was there as things were kind of building up. And it was pretty apparent to, I think, everybody that, you know, the north side was going to be locals and anti-protesters, and the south side was going to be the Proud Boys. So I was there, and I decided that I, you know, was going to try to be up front as much as possible. And so, like, the riot police had their line held up there under the bridge. And basically, as things kind of, after 11 o'clock, as things, you know, were kind of heating up, you could see there was a bunch of American flags kind of being walked around on the other side. The police kind of charged real quick and got everybody back out of the street. And right at that same moment, a news reporter was talking to his film guy or his cameraman and told him, hey, the Proud Boys are moving south. The Proud Boys are moving south. And so I wasn't there with anybody, and I thought, well, shoot, maybe I'll just follow these guys for a second. But it got pretty crazy with the police backing everybody up at that moment.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I was following them to go south, that's when you could see that the Proud Boys were being escorted across the bridge. And two people in front of me said, that's really odd that, you know, everybody knew that the bridge was closed and nobody has a permit to have a protest, and why are the police escorting them across the bridge? And then it looked like the police just kind of let everybody go towards the bridge. And I thought, oh man, they're not going to let them go, you know, following them. So I went back around to the other side, where I crossed over the Burnside Bridge. And I looked up in the air and I saw that the only police helicopter that was kind of surveying the area was actually over by the Omni parking lot. So I figured, perfect, that's got to be where they are. So we're running down the bike trail. Once I kind of got to the Omni parking lot area, I mean, I just walked right into the middle of all their, pretty much the end of the rally. And so I just kind of decided, you know, I didn't want to do anything too aggressive. So I just kind of put two thumbs down. And, you know, I started kind of just walking through the crowd, and I'm, you know, the only person there. And the one thing I noticed is there was maybe, what, 10 cops on their side for, you know, this entire thing that I had just witnessed over on the west side of the river. It was full riot police. I mean, they were doing procedures. They're hanging off the side of the car, and I have 10 police officers with yellow t-shirts on, and they had helmets on, but I mean, they're just 10 police officers over here. And I thought that was really surprising, but I felt really like exposed a little bit because there was no one else there. But I just started walking through the crowd a little bit. People started yelling things like, good thing you have the, you know, your right of your freedom to speech, because we're the ones that gave it to you. Kind of held my ground, and I just kind of had my thumbs down. And after about 2 minutes, about six police officers just came over, and they told me that I was being an agitator. And I mean, I could understand what they were saying. And I asked them, I said, I'm standing in the street. If I stand on the sidewalk, can I stay here? And they said, look, you're really agitating the situation. And I just looked back, I said, you're being respectful, I'll be respectful. So I didn't want to leave because I didn't see anybody else filming anything over here. And so I kind of just hung around in the back, and now I've been there for maybe 10 minutes at the most. And they said, all right, everybody, that's it. And they broke up the rally, and about half of them left. But there's a few really interesting things that I noticed after. Like, well, one, there was a lot of cars. They had already all pre-parked at where they had crossed over, and you just go down a set of stairs, and there's a parking lot right there by OMSI. And then they went over to kind of one corner, and they were hanging out. And that's when I saw somebody I recognized from the rally on the other side. And when I was up front with the police, not with the police, but, you know, face-to-face with the police, there was a guy who's, you know, over 6'5", 6'7". And he just looks like this gladiator-style guy. He's full riot gear. And so as I'm standing across at the end of the Proud Boys rally back over on their side, there he comes up with about six other people, all with black shirts on and bandanas and all the riot gear. And they had been all down there and everything. And this was all the Proud Boys' friends. And they were like, oh, you know, welcoming them back and whatnot. And so legitimately, they just had some huge people over there in full, you know, to say Antifa gear, basically riot mask, you know, chest protector and everything. And I just couldn't believe that. You know, I felt like, one, they had implanted people over there, and then the other part, they didn't accidentally end up on that side of the river. It just seemed weird that the police worked with out-of-towners and then again, basically the local people of the city.
That was KBOO News Director Althea Billings speaking with Sean Stevens, an eyewitness to last Saturday's demonstrations. Thank you for listening to Totality of Circumstances this week. You can hear old shows and extended interviews on our page at kboo.fm and get in touch with us anytime at totalityradio@gmail.com. I'm Sam Bowman, and you're listening to KBOO Portland, your community radio station.
You're listening to KBOO KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. Next up is Preference with Hedda.
KBOO proudly co-sponsors the Portland Folk Music Society concert series, featuring artists touring nationally and internationally. Shows start this September with Jim Queskin and Meredith Axelrod. The new season continues with artists Bill Staines, Radim Zenkel, and the Honey Whiskey Trio. Then 2020 kicks off with Kate Lee and Forrest O'Connor, followed by Sam Ryder and the Human Hands, Robin and Linda Williams, Pat Donahue, and Joni Harms. Portland Folk Music Society concerts are presented at the Reedwood Friends Church on Southeast Steel Street in Portland. For more information, go to the website kboo.fm and click on Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Bonds Over Borders on Tuesday, August 27th at 6 p.m. at the Cleaners at Ace Hotel in Portland. Bonds Over Borders is a benefit for Innovation Law Lab, a Portland-based organization that works to increase legal access for immigrants